Hi, my name is Peter Torkelson, and I'm an alcoholic. It's only the second time I've ever said that. Usually just, hi, I'm Peter, and I'm an I was just thinking back to the other time that I said that. There was a, I was at my home group, which is Venice Beyond Baroque Sunday morning. Tomorrow morning. And some guy was talking about the question of anonymity, not in the sense that it's a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, but in the sense that, you know, we don't go telling on each other, and, you know, just common courtesy, really. Anyway, he was saying he didn't want to be recognized outside the meetings. He didn't want any other alcoholics to say, hi, didn't I see you at such and such a meeting? And I feel very different about it. I said, my name is Peter Torkelson, and I'm an alcoholic, and I don't believe that this, you know, and it says even in the literature that we're not supposed to stay anonymous within the fellowship. It's only to keep, you know, the outside world from dumping all over us, and, you know, pointing the finger and getting crazy at us. The guy after me shared, he said, my name is, and I am. There's anonymity for you. And I have the following to say, and then he ran out the door. No, I made that part up. He didn't. Well, you know, what it used to be like, what it happened, what it's been like since. I meeting and talking to other alcoholics, I find that if I actually start talking about the amount of booze that I actually put away on a regular basis, it's like not even in the middle of the pack. I'm a pretty high bottom drunk, as you folks go. You know, when I tell people on the outside what I drank, they go, gee, that's a pretty fair amount of booze, isn't it? I mean, I drank less than a case of beer a day. How do you like that? I was sharing at one meeting, some guy said, I spilled my... He drank in quarts of malt liquor what I drank in 12-ounce cans of, you know, wussy American beer. When I told him what I drank that for lunch. I guess I must not be an alcoholic then. He didn't admit I was an alcoholic until I started ragging the government. I don't know why that convinced him, but it did. At one point during my struggles, you know, I mean, I knew that I was in trouble with beer and booze, and I mean, a beer was my drink of choice because I would pass out before I'd black out, and I needed to know what I had done the night before. I mean, I hear people say I love blackouts. I didn't want to know what I was doing. I had too much of a conscience. I needed to know what I had done the night before. I mean, it was so. And beer with me, I would pass out before I blackout. So I stayed with beer pretty much. And when I knew I was in trouble with this stuff, I thought maybe if I just keep track of it, I'll get to see what's happening. Maybe it'll, you know, just paying attention to it will make it disappear. So I put up a sheet of paper next to the refrigerator and, you know, a pencil on a string and made a little mark every time I had a beer. And then I'd look at the things, you know, and it'd be 6, 7, 8, 7, 8, 6, 5. Oh, boy, I've got this thing licked. 6, 7, 8, 9, 7, 9. Little black mark where I lost track. 6, 7, 9, 7, 8, 6, 5. Oh, boy, I got this thing sewed. 9, black mark, 6, 9. And, I mean, like sheet after sheet, just like only... If anything, of course, it was getting slightly. And I wasn't an alcoholic. Everybody whose story I ever heard who came to this point in their story defined alcoholism so as to exclude themselves. I can't be an alcoholic because they, you know, fill in the blank, and I don't. Therefore, you know, my image of alcoholics was people who... you know, when deprived of their booze, screamed and begged and pleaded and bargained and apologized and screamed and begged and pleaded. And I didn't, you know, and I didn't, you know, went to the hospital once and I was in jail once and I didn't drink during those times. And that was proof positive, you know, and I didn't have the serious, terrible withdrawal symptoms. And that was proof positive that I wasn't an alcoholic. When I got out of the hospital, I was on a course of antibiotics. They told me not to drink while I had those things, so I skipped the last one just so I could drink. But I wasn't an alcoholic. Best definition of alcoholism I think I may have ever heard, I heard on Mary Hartman, Mary Hartman. Some of you are too young to remember that program. But at one point, the old Indian chief says, you're an alcoholic if alcohol interferes with any important part of your life. And I go, uh-oh. When I got out of the hospital, my wife said, this might be a good time for you to cut back on your drinking. I said, I'll keep it down to 4 beers a day. She said, try 3. Okay, 3. So I would buy a 6-pack and bring it home and knock back 3 just like that. Was that 3? And then I would spend the rest of the night not drinking. You know where the expression white-knuckle sobriety came from? The other beers would call me from the refrigerator. Peter, come drink me. And I struggled to keep up. I mean, my wife said to me, talked to me about my drinking in 2 different tones of voice. One of them was, you know, Peter, your drinking is damaging our life. It said perfectly flat, perfectly straight ahead, without any, you know, extra something behind it. And I heard that. I went, yeah, you're right. I know that. I could tell. The other way that she talked about it was, you're drunk! And that I responded to in what I thought was perfectly logical manner by criticizing her housekeeping, which seemed made all kinds of sense to me. I don't know. Well, I got an offer to go on the road doing what I call a bogus band version of... Well, most of you guys know this already, okay? I'll just lay it out there. I used to belong to the Monkees. And this offer I got was, we'll do a show, call it, like, we'll say it's the Music of the Monkees show or something. You'll be the only one in there, and we'll pay you, you know, X bucks to go do it. And it was the best offer I had on the table at the time, so I went for it. Well, all the controls came off, except, well, not all the controls came off. I still wasn't an alcoholic. Here's why. I knew that I could not safely drink more than one drink a show. So I would drink one drink a show, do the show, have another drink, do the show. And then I would reward myself for being such a good guy by getting shit-faced, you know? And the road is great. Most of the places, they don't care how much you drink after the show. They don't. They'll just give you what you want. And I would crawl into the motel, blitz to the wheels, crawl out again after only about 4 hours, because that's about, you know, I have to get on the road again, I have to be on the road, 8 hours to the next destination. Crawl into the van, which is all we were driving in at the time, with a great big cup of coffee, wondering why this much coffee wasn't getting it. Used to be enough, you know, this much used to be enough to get me straight at the next morning. But I would crawl in the van, and I would pretty much come around by the time it was showtime the next night. So I'd have one, do a show, have one, do the next show, and get shit-faced. And this went on for the several months, 2 or 3 months that I was on the road. And the road suddenly dropped me. It just, there were no more dates. The thing just completely collapsed. I was on the East Coast. And I stayed there, thinking that I had to do this for my career. And I was staying with a friend of the family's. Wonderful woman, friend of 4 generations of my family, incredible. Friend to my grandmothers and friend to my children. It was really great, great, great lady. Anyway, but she had an apartment deep in the well of one of those tall apartment buildings in New York. If you've ever been there, you know that some of them, they have nothing, they got an air shaft down the middle, and she was on the 4th floor of a 12-story apartment house, so not much light got in there. And it was very darkly decorated. It was a perfect place for me to hit my bottom, and I overstayed my welcome there, which was just... And while I was there, At one point, this is what happened. I had a can of beer in my hands, and I suddenly realized that I had not had any connection. I hadn't said anything to myself. I hadn't made any mental outreach. You know, usually every beer, as far as I know, up till then was, I think I'll have a beer, or, gee, a beer would be great right now, or, gosh, I guess I'll have a beer. Oh, okay, I can have a beer now, huh? Okay. Something. Any kind of a mental thing that said, now a beer. And I looked at this can of beer I had in my hands, and I had not had anything like that. And my experience was completely as if I had been operated on. And the picture I like to draw is, I mean, it's like those Saturday morning cartoons, you know, where our hero, the little dog who walks like a man, is like trapped in the hypno ray of the evil alien Dr. Glick, who is circling Earth in low orbit on a spaceship with, you know, cackling gleefully as he pulls levers, which cause our hero, the dog who walks like a man, to walk over to the refrigerator, open the door, and grab a beer and pour it down his throat. And all the while with the eyes like spirals, you know, ding, 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 click, 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 I must have, click, 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 click. That's what it was like for me. There was just no control. You know, somebody else was doing this. And I actually got to see, finally, after, like I said, 3 or 5 years of like back and forthing with this thing, that this stuff had me in its control, not the other way around. And you know, I didn't have massive things with automobiles and terrible trouble with the law, and my stuff was much simpler. I couldn't carry on an intelligent conversation after the first about beer and a half, and it all just shut down. You wouldn't know it if you didn't know me, because I didn't slur my words, and I would, you know, parrot my old tapes. I had a whole stack of tapes back here, you know, complete encyclopedias on any topic, and I would just rattle them off to you at any, you know, say the right cue, and I would say, but if you posed an original thought, if you asked me a question that required some thought, I couldn't handle it. It all shut down. All the real stuff shut down after about a beer and a half. And I can't tell you how many nights with the ninth beer, you know, putting the ninth beer can in the trash and going to bed, and suddenly the room is spinning. I go, what did I do this for? I didn't mean to. I didn't want to. I don't like it. You know, and that was for years and years. And you know, snarling at my wife, and I mean, I gave my son a haircut one morning, and my hand was doing this, and I said, it's too much coffee. My wife said, you drank too much last night. That's what it says. It's booze in your system. So it was like, you know, I could see my life. Finally, I got to see my life shutting down, or I should say more now that I look back, my life was shutting down, but it was the spins and no contact and the isolation and snarling and the sorrow and, you know, running, being a sneak and a furtive thing, a little weasel, you know, scurrying under the woodwork and like that. It was really miserable. It was that one. That was the hard part, you know. It wasn't about the car wrecks or the anything else. It wasn't about the outside life. It was the inside life. It was not happy. I was not a happy camper. And I like to think of myself as a happy-go-lucky kind of guy, you know, pretty cheerful, generally, pretty upbeat. It wasn't good. So when I finally saw that I had no control over this stuff whatever, I was able to make a commitment to come to AA. What I did, actually, I knew I was flying back out here, and I said, I won't drink once I land. So I had 3 farewell scotch and sodas. I did it that way. That's how I did it. Okay. Somebody else I met said they had their farewell drinks, and I don't. But so I had some farewell drinks, 3 scotches and sodas, and I got off the plane and what happened was interesting. There was an interesting sort of little moment. I was at my wife's graduation. She was just finishing up college. And I was sitting with somebody who had just about drunk us out of house and home the previous Christmas. And I said to her, you know, I wasn't going to drink, but I feel like I better have a drink. And she said, no, if you ain't drinking, don't drink. And I didn't. And that was that. I asked around for, you know, found some people I knew who were in AA and found a meeting and went to it. I haven't had a drink ever since. And that was over 13 years ago. It is not, however, my date. Because I came in on the third tradition. I wanted to quit drinking, and I quit drinking. Requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I had it, but I did not have a desire to quit smoking pot. And if somebody had a line of cocaine to give me in the meantime, I didn't have a desire to turn that down either. But I went to meetings. I went to a lot of meetings. I went back to New York, and I went to 5 meetings a day, a couple of times a week. I must have gone to over 1,000 meetings in that first year, and I don't think I went to but maybe one too many. I remember which one it was, too, but I won't go into that long. And here in Southern California, you know, back, especially up in, I don't know how you guys are down here, and you're probably even more laid back than we are in L.A., only they weren't laid back up there. They were putting their fingers through my chest. You're a lying motherfucker. You ain't sober until you, and you, you know, and I'd get up at the podium every so often at pitch meetings, and I'd say, well, and I'm still smoking, and people would get up here, and they would be white-faced and in a rage, you know. You know, like I was going to contaminate them or something. I don't know what. In New York, they were very different. You know, they said, hey, you know, the requirement for membership is a desire. I don't personally believe that you can be sober and high at the same time, but the literature just says desire to quit drinking. So that was a whole lot easier for me. And I mean, people would say, you know, I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but I smoked pot for a while, and it's a lot better since I quit, and so on and so forth. And I did a lot of wrong, and I did all this. I didn't know sponsor, and I got involved with. I mean, they tell you don't get involved inside the first year, and I don't know if anybody ever hasn't, but I certainly didn't. And when the when that thing collapsed, and I mean it collapsed with the, I should say, all the sweet, gentle care of somebody slamming a piano lid on your fingers in the middle of some serious, you know. I ran to this guy who'd been sort of hanging, you know, and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, we can talk about it. So we sat down and talked about it, and I said I was still smoking pot, and he said, I won't sponsor you if you keep on smoking pot. I said, I'll be your friend, but I won't sponsor you. He said, you don't have to quit right now. You don't have to quit tomorrow. You can quit Tuesday. So Monday night, I smoked everything I could get my hands on. And I almost thought, my roommate had locked up the good stuff, boy, and I was tempted to put it off. But like, you know, the way these things are for me, if I don't honor this like hinge thing, you know, this pivot point, if I say, okay, name the pivot point, I'll quit Tuesday, you know. If I don't honor that, I don't know that I'll ever be able to get to it. And so I really did, I honored it. I smoked what I could get my hands on Monday night, and then Tuesday morning I called him up and said, hi, it's your new sponsee. And that was January 13th, I think. At least that's the date I chose. Over 12 years ago, 13 years coming up. Now, I am real grateful for the time that I didn't drink, because I really did want to quit drinking. And the reason that I don't smoke pot or do coke or anything else, why I don't consciously allow any mood-altering chemical into my system, is because I don't want to drink. And for me, it's all about staying sober, as is all the rest of this stuff. Now, hang on a second. Break at 9:30. How much time do you need before we quit? 5 minutes to close down? 5 minutes to close down?
9:29.
9:29, 56 seconds. Okay. Because what AA has given me, recovery has given me, what AA gave me recovery. What recovery has given me really, so far, has been, mostly it's been the chance, a chance. Now, I still have eyes to be a rock and roller. At my age, you'd think I'd have outgrown the ambition, but I haven't. That's still what I want to do. I get off playing that good grooving rock and bop and blues and roll music. That's the stuff that sends me, to use an old expression. And that's what I want to do. And I'm not doing it these days. It's not happening in that way. There was a reunion tour in the late 80s, and it was a lot of fun. Put some money in the bank. I don't have to work. Thank you very much. But it's not what I want to do. What I want to do is play rock and roll. Not rock, what's called rock these days. It's noise. I don't understand that shit. I want to hear something, you know, like Melancholy Baby. Nah. Except, of course, for Been Caught Stealing by Jane's Addiction. Now, there's a killer piece of music. Anyway, there was no prayer. And there would be no prayer again if I were still drinking, or if I were to start drinking again. Some of you may have heard you pick up where you left off. Most of you probably know better. The evidence is that you pick up where you would have been if you had been drinking continuously. And I do not want to pick up with 12 more years of drinking behind me. You know, like I said, I didn't wreck cars, and I didn't, you know, and I still had some small measure of acceptance in my family. Not much, but some. And if I were to drink with the power of 12 more years of drinking under my belt, I know it would be all gone. I would be, if I were alive at all and not institutionalized, I would be some senseless, blithering pile of protoplasm in a gutter somewhere, and that would be about as good as it got. It's not a pretty thought, and it's what's facing me if I pick up again. So recovery has given me a chance, you know. This, more importantly than my ambition for myself as an entertainer and a professional ambition, though, is what's come to me as a result of recovery being about cohering as a person. You know, I was at a meeting 2-3 weeks ago, and I saw this woman. I had never met her before, and she was crying in the corner. And after the meeting, what's going on? You want to talk about your troubles? And we wound up going to coffee, and after we talked for a couple hours, in the course of which she began to feel better and calm down. And she said to me, you know, you're really sane. And two or three people lately have said, two or three other people have said the same thing to me. You're really sane. Now, think back to any time before you came in. Would you have thought that was a compliment? At best, it would be something completely neutral, you know. You're really sane. Compared to who? Or what, you know? Are there any loonies running around here that I don't see? I mean, or am I the only one you see here? I don't... It's just... And yet, you know, I mean, maybe I haven't been restored to sanity. Maybe, you know, fooled you guys. Walter Cronkite once said, if you can get integrity faked, then the rest is a piece of cake. And that's the way I feel here. Once I can get, you know, sanity faked, and then, hey, everything else falls right into place. Partly what I know about sanity, the one thing that I have to bring to you guys that you I know you know this anyway, but I'll say it just because I'm up here and I got the microphone and you're sitting there and you're listening to me, is that sanity does not mean that my mind is in order at all times. This is the great relief that has come to me. Sanity does not mean that I can't have a crazy thought. Sanity isn't even a place. Sanity is just a compass point. Hence the way I face. And that means that when I get crazy, and after I've been crazy for a while, I start asking for help, and I find out what made me crazy, and I begin to assemble the tools that it takes to meet that kind of a situation, and the next time the same situation comes up, it doesn't make me as crazy. Sanity is just like, you know, it's like this. There's, you know, heat-seeking missiles? They got, like, three sensors or something like that, and they aim at the tail of this jet, and they go, there it is, you know, and they're too far to the right, and they move to the left. And then they overshoot, and they know that they're too far to the left, and so they move to the right, and they know they're too far up, and so they go down, and they know they're too far down, and they go up. In fact, they are off course about 99% of the time, and they hit it every time. Blurry! That's what sanity is like. You're off course about 99% of the time, you know? But sanity just means that we pay attention to these correcting devices. It's called cybernetics. Just the science of cybernetics and sanity. An amazing combination if you can get it. So, that's my discourse on sanity. We are taping, aren't we? Okay. I want extra royalties for that one. Well, let's see. Okay. Now, the other day, I was completely insane. I absolutely, you know, it's like yesterday or something. I don't know what it is, you know. One thing might be that I heard that I was sane so much that I had recoil. And I went crazy. I know, I see this a lot. You know, a lot of us think that once we've done something right, that everything's going to fall into place, and then we drive into a tree or something, you know. And so we really sort of have to watch out extra carefully when things are going well. Because I know for myself, or at least this is what I assemble in my own mind, for better or for worse. We think that the rule is don't get well. We, you know, we come from these households where they really loved us to be sick. There was a lot of virtue, you know. We were the sick ones in our household. Some of us were the only sick. You heard the first frog across the freeway. A lot of us came from these households where they wanted us to be sick because then they didn't have to notice that they were sick themselves. So if we started to get well, it made them crazy. They weren't having us well. They didn't want us well, you know. And we get out of those things, we start to get into recovery, and we think we have broken the rule, and we think we're okay, and then we drive into a tree. And what I want to tell you is the rule is not don't be okay. Because if it were, then once we were okay, we would have broken the rules and we'd be home free. The rule is if you get to feel okay, you're going to have to pay like hell for it. So when you get to feeling good, that's the time to be extra special on your guard, stay real close to the program, call people extra much when you're feeling good. You know, because that's when it's the most dangerous. That's what I've just, this is one little extra clue that I bring back from my insanity, I guess. I don't know what. Anyway, I was feeling real squirrely the other day. Maybe it was this backlash, and maybe it was this other thing. I saw somebody, a woman that I'd been seeing around the rooms, and she had, you know, shed 15 pounds and was looking just sleek as a fox. She was just intense, and she'd always been kind of, you know, nice and cute. This wasn't cute. This was, you know, Glamour magazine cover girl or something out of the blue. Pow! And I almost didn't recognize you. I asked her how it happened. What happened? How did you lose the weight? How did you get to look so sleek? And she said, I just at some point became willing to own myself. And I felt real awful the next day. And I think maybe besides the thing about the backlash from the sanity stuff and all that stuff, like I was talking about, what it might have been was that I actually am afraid to own myself. Now, you know, I know that you look at this famous face over here, you know, and you go, what's he got to worry about? He doesn't have to work for a living. He's got money. And the truth is that I stand here facing you guys. I'm shaking in my boots because what the monkeys was for me was a diversion. It was a way of avoiding myself. That was just that character I played. Those of you who don't know the show, I played a kind of a simpleton character. Recognize the guy, huh? Oh, I know. Oh, you were that one. I get it. Okay. And in reality, of course, I am suave and intelligent and articulate and distingué. And when I was growing up, when I was a kid in Greenwich Village, playing the basket, passing coffee houses, I was jealous and envious of those other kids who were singing the blues and working on the blues, and I couldn't do it. I just couldn't bring myself to do it. Now, as it happens, I have begun work on some of these issues in other programs. Let me make a quick sidelight here. If you are under a year sober, clean and dry, get sober. Get your year. Don't do another thing. Put everything else on the shelf. I believe it was my experience and the experience of everybody I've ever seen around me. It takes a year to get sober, just to get sober. I began going to some other programs, in my case starting at about 4 years sobriety, and to deal with some other issues. You will hear in these rooms that the big book, 12 Steps to Alcoholics Anonymous, have everything you need. And maybe it's true and maybe it isn't. I don't know for a fact, because I have found myself in other programs to take care of some other issues. I do know that there are issues that I cannot talk about in an AA room because some of you are sufferers of those issues and not surrendered, and you will abuse me. Just like when you go into, you know, you're in your family with your family and they want you to drink and you go, no, I don't want to drink. And they go, what's the matter with you? You can drink like a man. That's abuse. And that's the kind of abuse you will get from people who are not surrendered to their alcoholism. And that's why we come into these rooms, because everybody here is surrendered to their alcoholism. And we know that if we talk about wanting a drink, nobody's going to laugh at us or abuse us on that account. And that's one of the wonderful things we get from the fellowship. Some of you people are not surrendered to your debting problems. You're not surrendered to your artistic problems. And you'll abuse me if I talk about those, if I open up and if I'm vulnerable to those in front of all of you. So I go to other rooms on that account. I repeat, none of this is for anybody under a year clean and dry. Get your year. The other stuff will come off the shelf and hit you on the head soon enough. You know, stay. First things first. I haven't got a fucking prayer if I'm not sober. And what I'm here for is my prayer. My prayer at a shot. I want a complete life. I hope it involves the career, the above-mentioned career, as a rock musician. That's what I want to do professionally. If it doesn't, I don't care. What I'm interested in above all is assembling a complete life. I use the 12 steps as they apply to alcoholism, as they apply to my other situations, as they apply to my life. I've had some recent wonderful experiences turning it over. I couldn't get out of bed one day. And I turned it over. I got out of bed. It was just like that. I really had an experience like, I can't get out of bed this morning. And I went, they tell me to surrender that stuff. So I did. I just went, okay, God. And the next thing I knew, I was on my feet making coffee. And I looked back, I said, who did that? I mean, it was the experience. Now, you know, you take this to the outside world and they're going to go... But some of you, most of you guys know what I'm talking about. There was this moment where I couldn't, just couldn't. And so I said, hey, God. Now, Okay. So, what this complete life is going to look like. Obviously, if I knew, it would already have happened. It's got to be a surprise to me. If it isn't a surprise, it's already passed. You know what I mean? Everything is either a surprise or dead. That's basically, that's it, you know. And I don't know where I'm going with this. I don't know what a complete life looks like for me. I know how to tell when I'm off track. I have these cybernetic sensors. When I'm getting real squirrely, when issues start to make me crazy, when I get a letter and it starts making me run around eating a lot of chocolate, you know, then I know that some issue has been joined, that something is going on. And that tells me that that is the focus of my next work. That's the work I have to do. So anytime there's any squirreliness, anytime there's any looniness, that is my work. And so the point is, go towards your resistances, go towards your struggles, go towards your disturbances, because that's where your work is. I mean, listen, if you can't, don't. Believe me, this is not about 100% all the time charging forth. You know, this is a three steps forward, two steps back kind of a life. We've seen that over and over and over again. But generally speaking, your life is where your disturbances are. The things that piss you off are where your growth is going to be. I hope I'm listening to this because I need to hear it. So like I said, I don't know what a full life is, but I know how to, I know, you know, where it is. And what I was going to say earlier is that I'm shaking my boots here, because all of that fame that I had did not touch what I wanted or needed. You know, I got, when the fame started to come to me and we played in front of tens of thousands of screaming kids at one point, you know, I thought, this is going to be hot stuff. And it worked fine for a while. Booze worked fine for a while. But it didn't touch the main stuff. It didn't touch the real stuff, which was how awful I felt inside and why, you know, I thought this fame was going to fix me. And I wasn't going to be lonely anymore. Didn't work. And I've been good friends with people for years, only to discover that they thought that it was perfect having had the life I wanted. And they didn't see, you know, they didn't know who I was. What it is that I was missing, and you know, what I thought fame would fix, is that great big gaping hole in here that, you know, where the wind whistles through and it's like standing naked on top of a mountain in the middle of winter, naked. That I'm beginning to get, you know, I'm beginning to get clothed and sheltered and warmed up a little bit, and this is slowly filling up a little bit at a time. And I think one way of describing what it is that I'm after is a full heart and a full, like I said, a full life and a full heart. I want to be, and I am growing more content with the private guy inside. Torkelson, not Torque. That's the gift of recovery. And you people gave that to me. Now, I've run over by about 8 seconds, but I'm going to go on anyway. Just because I want to say the following real quick thing. I almost never get around to talking in any detail about my relationship with my higher power, but I just want to say this much about it. What I understand my higher power to be is a spectrum of experiences. One of them is the fact that I couldn't get sober by myself, and that with you people on my side, I can. In other words, you are a power greater than myself in my search for recovery. And I need you very much. And you might say that I'm in the presence of my higher power even as I speak. And I'm very grateful. Thank you very much.